Good morning. My name is Richard Spike, and I am an alcoholic. I'm a proud member of the West Side Men's Group. The West Side Men's Group, brief group history. Oh, good. I'm very good. The West Side Men's Group, October 25th, 2003. June 1st, the idea was first discussed in the Rose Garden at the Senecal Retreat House to start a men's meeting by a few said men. October 18th of 2001, the first meeting was held at St. Gregory's Catholic Church in the outside pavilion. There were 10 attendees, and the meeting topic was life and acceptance. The first business meeting, we elected officers. October 25th of 2001, we created the first group phone list. On July 11th of 2002, the meeting moved to Plantation United Methodist Church, where the meeting was held here in the library. The meeting size on October 10th of 2002 was 35 to 40, and the average was in the mid-30s, quickly outgrowing our room size. November 12th of 2002, the group received a letter from GSO providing official notice that we were now a registered group. April of 2003, the group moved from the library to the fellowship hall. October 2nd of 2003, 51 men attended the regular meeting, and last year, on October 25th, 2003, we had the first inaugural breakfast. Since that time, the group has flourished, not only from my opinion or group members' opinion, but from the size of the group itself. The West Side Men's Group is not the greatest men's group that I've ever been involved with because my sponsor is a group member or because my five or six best friends in my life are group members. The reason why it is the greatest collection of men that I've ever been associated with is because of their fellowship and brotherly love. Almost all the members of the West Side Men's Group have the burn in their belly for AA the way that I do, the way that my sponsor does, the way I was taught. But it's deeper than that. In most groups of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the time that I'm sober, you see cliques. The cliques are in meetings, and it could be very, very good, but also, for the newcomer, it's very, very dangerous. As a lot of you know with more time than me, the cliques could drive people out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not in this group. The cliques are not four or five men in this group. They are 50 men cliques. The cliques are not the guys with the time hanging with the guys with the time. The cliques in this group are the guys with the time bringing their sponsees and their grand sponsees, and the guys without the time make this group happen. In closing,
right on time.
The West Side Men's Group. Oh. The West Side Men's Group is a very special bunch of men. But more importantly than that, we do what Alcoholics Anonymous gave us, which is our primary purpose is to give it away and to pass it on. Whether it's 30, 40, 50 people going to dinner after the meeting, or somebody struggling, somebody gives it away with old school AA, somebody not as old school. I went to 8 or 9 group members with less than 3, 4, 6, 8 months sober. They all gave me the same opinion, what attracts them to this special bunch of men. Nobody is better than anybody else. Nobody feels that their time is anything other than their time was accumulated because they were fortunate enough to get here before the other men. Now the younger men and the more vibrant men have a primary purpose in this special group of men to pass this thing along for many, many years to come. Thank you.
Thanks, Mikey. Okay, Dave Z, another group member, is going to come up and read how it works from the fifth chapter of the Big Book.
Good morning, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is David. And I'm a member of the Westside Men's Group. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. But we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Thank you. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were so.
A stirring rendition of how it works. I don't think I've ever cried at how it works before. And I have to wonder why. I'm sure I will many more times now. Thank you, David. Thank you. John B., another group member, is going to come and read our 12 traditions. All right.
I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm proud to be a member of this group. And I just want to say I'm a member of this group because of the likes of the men like David and other people that you've seen today. Very attracted to this group, and I'm grateful that it's in existence. 12 traditions of AA. Number one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought not ever endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous shall remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA, as such, ought never to be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Right. Thank you.
All right. Before I bring up Andy, I got to tell you, this morning we had a meeting at 7 o'clock, some of us that had worked on the breakfast, and we read some meditations, and we were talking, and one of the guys said, I think it was Bobby, you know, I looked down the list, and I look at the members of this group, and there's someone that has expertise in every area. You know, it might have been Dave, I can't remember, but you look down the list, and there's someone that's handled everything. Anything you can go through, you can find a guy in the group. You know, and I said, well, you know, put me down out there. I gained my bachelor's degree in character defects. You know, basically, and I came to AA, and I got my master's in the solution. You know. And that's what it's like, you know, in this group we have that. And what we also do is we tend to find guys that aren't members of this group and that have a particular skill, and we kind of suck them in, even though they're not official members. We still want them, and we've done that with Andy Kay. He's going to come up and explain our seventh tradition and tell you a little bit about where the money goes. Andy?
Good morning. My name is Andy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Thank you for coming. We appreciate it. I can't believe the turnout. This is great. Hope everybody enjoyed breakfast. And we're going to pass the baskets in accordance with our seventh tradition, which states that every group ought to be fully self-supporting and declining outside contributions. So in addition to paying for the food and the hall and the supplies and everything, whatever's left over is going to go to intergroup and local District 9. So thank you for your support, and thanks for coming out.
All right. Thanks. All right. We're getting very close to the speaker, I promise. Before we do that, what I would like to do is ask at this time for the members of the West Side Men's Group to please stand up. What I'd like to tell you folks, is these guys worked really hard on this breakfast. Each of them contributing something different that is their particular skill or their passion, and what they produced was this breakfast for you. A couple people I'd like to particularly point out. They've all done an outstanding job, but Mark R., one of our newest members, is a gentleman who designed this poster. And I just think it's great. Mark, where are you? Mark's right here. Outstanding. Outstanding. And I would also like to recognize Ernie R., who was our chairman for the entire event. He coordinated all the individual chairs in their different... And then I would very much like to recognize Chris C. and Harry B., who headed up the kitchen staff and did all the cooking. Chris, please stand up, Chris. I want you folks to know that we were setting up last night. We were finishing up. Chris, there he is. We were setting up last night, a bunch of us, and that was pretty easy work. We were done by about 10:30, and we were kind of sitting around talking, and I said to Chris, "You getting ready to take off?" He said, "No." He said, "My group is coming in at 11, and we're going to be here all night cooking, getting ready for the breakfast." And they did that. They pulled an all-nighter so that you guys could have this breakfast this morning. So we appreciate it. The good kind of all-nighter, not the kind we used to do before. All right. At this time, what we're going to do is we're going to have, we have a very special Westside Men's Group member with us today. One of our members about 3 months ago decided that he was going to sell everything he owned, buy an RV, and start basically touring the country with him and his wife and his Harley. And he's been doing that, but we're fortunate enough to have him back today for this breakfast. And he's going to lead us in a sobriety countdown. Joel?
I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Westside Men's Group. My name is Joel Pashkin. And what we're going to do is we're going to do a countdown. We're going to find out who the person here with most sobriety, the person with the least sobriety, and the one with the most sobriety is going to give a big book to the person with the least sobriety. So, please bear with me. So everybody who is in this room who's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, please stand up. Okay. Now, if anybody who has 3 months or less of sobriety, please take your seats. 3 months or less. Okay. Now, 6 months or less, please take your seats. 9 months? Okay, anybody with less than 1 year, please take your seats. Okay, anybody that's got between 1 and 2 years, less than 2 years, please take your seats. Between 3 and 4 years. Or 2 and 3. So two and three. All right, anybody with less than 4 years, please take your seat. 5 years. 10 years. Anybody with less than 10 years. 15 years. 20 years is where I would sit down. 25 years. All right. Thirty years. All right. Woo! Should I count by ones or more fives still? One. 31 years. 32 years. Woo! 33 years, 34, 35, 35, here we go, how many years, 43 years, woo! 23 years. All right. Somebody told me in order to be an old timer, all you have to do is don't pick up a drink and don't die. All right. Can you stay standing if it's not too much trouble? All right. That's good.
What up, Chuck?
Okay, anybody with 90 days or less, please stand up.
All right. Woo!
All right, people with 60 days, between 60 and 90, please take your seats. People with 30 days, up to 30 days, please. 30 to 60 days, I'm sorry. 30 to 60 days. 20 to 30 days. Ten to 20 days.
All right.
9 days. There we go. Right there. Two over there. Okay, 8 days. Seven days. 6 days. 5 days. 4 days. Two with 4 days. We got 2 with 4 days. Okay, is that right?
Tie.
Okay, both of you want to come up? So you two gentlemen, with a little bit of faith and effort, one day at a time, you can go from where you are right now, which is 4 days, to where this fine gentleman has with 43 years.
All right. Thank you, Joe, and our two newcomers were Randy and Tim, folks. All right. Not a moment we've all been waiting for. And waiting for. All right. Johnny G, who is the chairperson of our speaker committee. I got to tell you a little story about this. Last year, I was the chairperson of speaker committee, and it's now okay for me to openly admit that I had a hidden agenda. I had a gentleman in my mind for our first breakfast who was a friend of mine. Many of you know him, Pete C. from Fort Lauderdale. And I wanted Pete to be the speaker at this breakfast, so I pretended to go through due diligence and listen to other speakers and so on and so forth. But I had Pete in mind. I can admit that to you today. I suspect that John had this gentleman in mind as well, in the same way when he shot up, because we all heard Burns a couple years back in Daytona at the state convention. He was outstanding, outstanding. And since that time, I know he's been a favorite of John's. I also know we have some friends of ours from the Alternatives, and he's a favorite of theirs, too. And I'm really excited to hear his story this morning, and I'm going to let John come up and introduce him. John.
My My name's John. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a member of the group. I'll just briefly, my job also as chairman for the speaker committee is to pick the people who do the readings. So I will take credit for David Z's awesome rendition of How It Works. About when I was a year and a half sober, my sponsor took me to the Big Book Seminar, the Joe and Charlie Seminar. I don't even think I had a year and a half yet. And just like Loretta and Chuck, there was a big display set up. And there was all these CDs. And I never saw CDs and speaker on CD. And at the time, I just had gotten a job, newly sober, and $10 was a lot of money to me. And but I wanted to get a CD. And I think they were $7 or $8. So you have this giant assortment of CDs. I didn't know which one to choose. I didn't know much about AA. And I saw a gentleman's name, Burns B., from Louisville, and I thought, well, I'll just get it because this is a peculiar name. You know, I had no clue what the message was going to be, but like a, you know, a guy with a year sober, I figured, well, he's got a funky name, so I'll buy the CD. And I did. And I listened to it on my way home in the car, and it blew me away. I never heard a message like that, and I've heard some real good messages since then, but this really affected me. So in 1999, we noticed that Burns was going to be the keynote speaker at the Daytona Beach Convention Center, which was about 5 times the size of this room, maybe 20 times the size of this room. So we were already, like, he was a rock star for me, you know? So, and Chris, and Brad. So we all shot up in Armin, and we shot up to Daytona. I remember we got fifth row center. And we were standing there, and we were all like little schoolgirls, you know? I'm telling you, it really was. It was like little schoolgirls. And I remember me and Brad sitting there lighting our lighters, you know? And it was like a dead concert. And Burns gave his message, and he blew us away, and we drove back to Fort Lauderdale. And that was 5 years ago, about 5.5 years ago. So like Armin, I totally had ulterior motives, because if it was up to me, since you know, most of you who know me know I'm a complete control freak, I would have had Burns try to come down last year. But it was God's will and Armin's will that got Pete here, and Pete was awesome. If you were here, Pete was absolutely awesome. And I'm sure Loretta and Chuck have CDs if you want to hear last year. So what happened this year was I didn't look at any other speaker. My goal was to find Burns and track him down. Now, the interesting thing that's come to me in the last 48 hours is this guy doesn't know us from hole in the wall. He's never met me. I didn't meet him in Daytona. I never shook his hand. But he was willing to spend 5-6 hours in Atlanta airport last night being hung up with weather and planes and changes and come down here to speak at our breakfast. That's service. I mean, that's why I admire these types of folks. You know, that's who I want to emulate. Giving up their weekend, their time, their family time to come down here at no benefit, financial or whatnot, except for he's going to stay sober today. I don't think Burns is going to go back to the Hampton Inn and drink a bottle of bourbon tonight. You know? But I'm just in awe by that type of service, and that's what I want to be like. So I will end with, in closing, I love you, Richard, so much. Our friend Milton, who passed away a few years ago, used to always say, wherever you are, be there. Well, I'm here, you're here, the group is here, and Burns is here. So with that, Burns Brady.
Patient while I make a little nest up here. I'm going to be here a while. Reminds me of a speaker one time. I asked a conference, how long could I talk? They said, you can talk as long as you want to. We're going home in an hour. Everybody talks about how difficult it is to get humility in this organization. No, it comes pretty damn easy if you want to, you just listen. My name is Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Very grateful to be here. Rock star? I finally made it. Honest to God. I tried so hard drinking, it never worked. Anyway, you know, that's what the whole deal is about, is to have heroes. You know, there are not many places in that heroes are promoted as well as condoned. And in this program, that's exactly what happens. Or that's what's happened for me. And I remember going through many of those same feelings, and still do. I've got some real heroes. Virtually everybody in this program is a hero, but some of these people are still people I look at and think, my goodness, if you know, that's what I want to be, is the best example of the big book that anybody will ever read. And so I understand that mechanism. I appreciate you asking me to be here. This is a real privilege and a real honor. I thank Dave and John for picking me up and waiting out. John and I talked more on the telephone yesterday than we had in the previous year, trying to figure out where in the hell I was and if he's going to be patient enough to come there and greet me or meet me. Is that not coming through in the back? Is it okay? Worked for him, why not me, you know? That's right. It is really a privilege to be here. I have a real special affinity for the event that y'all are having today. My home group is a men's group. Meets on Tuesday night, and last weekend we had our annual retreat, and we all go out to a convent about 25 miles outside of Louisville, and we stay there from Friday at noon until Sunday at noon. It's a very special thing. We've had it now for 10 years. We started that group about 15 years ago, and then we decided to have this retreat. And these new young men coming in sobriety, the way that y'all's group is described is everybody being there for everybody. That's exactly why we started that group. We knew there would be a testosterone level. There wasn't any reason to try to say it wouldn't be there. It was going to be there. But the proper channeling of that testosterone level was exactly what this whole thing was about. Nothing wrong with testosterone, it's just when it spews in the wrong place and acts out in a different way, and that's no pun intended about when it spews in the wrong way. Another example of why God didn't want me to go off very often. But I love to be around men, I always have. And my first sponsor said, you know, you're fortunate because when you learn to live with your own kind, you got a better chance of getting sober. And I'm absolutely certain of that. I've been sober since December the 1st, 1977, so I've been around long enough to have some sense. I don't a lot of times, but I've been around long enough to have some sense. And I found that to be very true. Take out of that equation this deal of what goes on between men and women, usually in the games we played when we got here. To get into a men's group, we help them take that out of there. And we also continue to take it out of old-timers like me. Because that demon can arise in a heartbeat and play the same games that it started, and the run is on. You know, and fortunately, age and a little bit of recovery, maybe a lot of recovery, has taken that off of the table as far as action, but it still sits in my brain. Goes, boom, see, I've been in love 4 times in this room already this morning. And willing to make a commitment to at least 3 of them. Yeah. I mean, this isn't a sexist statement. That's just the way I've always been, you know. So I'm really grateful for this and y'all's response to this. This is very special for y'all, and it's a very great privilege for me. You've asked me to come and tell you a story. That story is what I was like, what happened, what I'm like today. This may not be your story. You may not be able to relate to how I got here. I hope if my mind stays in tune with the God who's given me the words, I'll be able to share with you a recovery process that will work for everybody who's going to stay in this program. But you may not have, your dues may not have been paid at the same club that mine were exactly the same way. So don't, if this isn't your story, keep coming back. My wife heard her story after 6 years in Al-Anon and switched to AA. And that's right, she heard her story. I mean, when she says she's a drunk, I just sit there and think, my God, you're a drunk. You know, as the old joke says, I spill more whiskey than you drank, but that's okay, you know. I wasn't a drunk. God only knows what I was when I got here. And Casey did not drink that much, but she understood what it did inside her to make her know that she was an alcoholic. And it took her 6 years to hear that story. So this may not be your story. One thing I would like to share with you is this is an individual journey. This is an individual journey. If I start comparing my program with you, and you start comparing your program to me, we're both in trouble. So it's an individual journey. It will be taken as an individual journey. It just must never be taken alone. For an alcoholic of my type, being alone is being in a crowd with a committee making weird decisions about strange situations. So it just must never be taken alone. But remember, this journey is going to be an individual journey, and it's just the way I found it to be for me and the multiple people I've had the distinct privilege and honor to work with. When I first started doing a lot of talking, and that's been about 20 years ago, almost 22, I'd been about 5 years sober, and I've gone back and listened to some of those tapes, and as I was telling somebody this morning, they're great tapes if you like humor. It wasn't my story, but it's a great tape if you like humor. Now, none of y'all knew it wasn't my story, so a lot of people still think they were great talks. Most of them were Father Martin's story, Sandy Beach's story. Go right on down the line, those people that were my heroes. But they were humorous. At that time, I really thought that I could express the gratitude I have for this program. I thought I could articulate it. I now know it's impossible for me to express the depth of my gratitude for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot do it. It's not within my power to do it with the language and words I've got. It just isn't possible. Not only has it given me, taken away the need to drink, it's given me the recovery process to find a God, and still continuing to find this God. It's given me two children that were going down the crapper. I've got a daughter, 43 years old, who's been in AA 23 years, and a son, 37, who's been in 21 years. We now can converse with the same language. And they were lost to me. They were basically lost to the world. But through various mechanisms, they got in, and now it's an incredible life. I've got a granddaughter and a grandson, blood granddaughter and grandson, whose statistical probability with their generations of previous alcoholism of being an alcoholic and drug addict in this society is 97%. But they're both being raised in a completely devoted spiritual home that is under the tutelage and following the guidelines of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when they get ready to come, they'll be ready. Remember when I went out to see my daughter being born in Omaha, you know, you go in there, and this was 7 years ago, and you go in there at the newborn nursery, and you look down there, and there they are in that little thing. They look like a piece of meat. You know, they're sitting in that deal. I delivered a lot of babies back when I was practicing medicine, and I thought how beautiful that child is because her head's straight. Most of the ones I delivered had kind of funny looking head. Thank God they all straightened out, at least most of them. But I thought, what a beautiful child. You know, you stand over your grandchild like that, and you think of UK, University of Kentucky, University of Louisville, Harvard, Yale, something. I'm looking at my baby granddaughters thinking, Hazleton, Betty Ford, and what's your home group? I was born in a little town in western Kentucky named Mayfield. 12,000 people, Bible Belt of western Kentucky. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol and there were no drugs. My mother was raised in a home where her father, my grandfather, died drinking bleach in the Mayfield City Jail in 1935. He was a bad alcoholic. My mother was raised in that home, and she was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. When my daddy had three brothers who were alcoholic, one of whom died drinking, the other two basically tore themselves up and died of complications of drinking. So when mother and daddy got together, they made a commitment that there would be no alcohol in their home. They didn't talk about drugs. That didn't exist at that point in time. So I was raised in a really loving home where there was no alcohol. and it was dominated by an adult child of an alcoholic. Now, if you have problems with that term and think it's therapeutic, go read the first page of The Family afterward. It says, if you're around one of us, you get neurotic. And my mother was neurotic. I adored that woman, adore even more today. She died in 78, and I miss her more every day. And the thinner my hair gets and the grayer it gets, the more I realize how wonderful gifted, how wonderfully gifted I was to have my mother and daddy. But my mother was goofy, and she dominated that entire home. And she dominated it predominantly by conditional love. When I was perfect, Mother patted my butt, parted my hair, and made me king baby, as T-Boat said. King baby. I was the center of the universe because she got her credibility by what her children did, at least to the open world. So when I was perfect, Mother would do those things, and when I got a B, or when I didn't perform perfectly, she wouldn't even talk to me. She didn't fuss at me. She ignored me. So I became aware of the fact that if you want a woman to take care of you and make you feel special, you give her everything she wants and be perfect, and that's the way to get it. And I got to tell you, I've worked with thousands of alcoholics, literally, and I've never seen a one coming in here that wasn't trying to be perfect. Praise God, this program tells us we don't have to be perfect. It even gives us a solution to deal with the fact we'll never be perfect. But I first learned this need for perfection as a part of conditional love from the dominant person in my life, my mother. Now, in my opinion, the second greatest thing that Bill Wilson ever wrote was Emotional Sobriety, which was a letter to the Central Office of the World Service Office Archivist in 1953. Wilson had been sober at that time, counted up 18 years. And in this, he said all of his problems were dependencies. Money, power, prestige, sex, approval, summarized by approval, approval. Whatever I would do to get approval, whatever I had to do to get approval, I began that almost from my very first conscious thought, the need to be perfect to get the approval. The second place I learned conditional love was in the church. Now, if you think I got a problem with church, you're wrong. When I came back, I was raised in the church 12 years, never missed Sunday school in church. When I came back from treatment, I worked with my Anglican priest and became a lay reader and administered the chalice and the host for 8.5 years. Then sat with him and my sponsor, and we concluded my ministry would be in AA because each of us has a ministry. There is no question each of us has a ministry. And we concluded that with the experience I'd had, AA was where my ministry would be. I was ready to go to seminary. I'd have gone. God, I dreaded it. I thought, oh, God, will I ever survive the seminary and the lifestyle thereafter? I just couldn't imagine me being there. And my good friend, the priest, said, no, I can't imagine you being there either. So I began my ministry. My ministry was here. So I need to tell you, I am a devout appreciator and lover of the church. That's me. That's my story. But in the church, I learned conditional love. It was believe this or we fry you like this. Now, that wasn't my perception. That's what I was told. And I mean, I had a real quandary. This is humorous, but listen to it. The Old Testament says it's better to spill your seeds in the belly of a whore than on the ground. Now, I'm a 12-year-old boy who's just found a new pool toy, and I'm having a real problem, you know? I mean, I am really having a problem. I mean, first of all, I only got a quarter of a week allowance, and there weren't many whores in Mayfield that I knew about, so I was going to have a hell of a time in a quarter of a week. So I did what 12-year-old boys do on Friday night and Saturday night, went up on Sunday, confessed, and they baptized me on Sunday night. And I've been baptized more often than most of y'all have had a glass of water. You know? This was conditional love. Perfect and follow this incredibly difficult and insane group of ideas, the way they were being taught to me. So I lived in this conditional love, the need to be perfect. Now, this didn't make me an alcoholic. I'm a doctor. I practiced 25 years of family medicine. I practiced the last 17 years. If you think I'm that old, that's an overlap in there, I promise you. But I practiced addiction medicine for the last 17 years. I'm one of the country's top experts in this field. Now, most of the doctors think I am because I know the neurotransmitters. Most of the drunks know I am because I've looked from the bottom of the bottle and laid in the gutter. So between the two, I'm able to walk in both worlds. And what I know is, and Wilson said, we're bodily and mentally different. Bodily different. The big book was talking about what we would know in science 60, 70 years before we found it out. Big book was saying women drink differently than men. Now we know they do, and we know why. It said that young people would drink differently from old people. And they do, and now we know why. Wilson's saying we have a physical, we're bodily and mentally different. And we're bodily different because we're born to court low. Now, I can even tell you what's in that court. But we're born to court low, and when we drink, we fill up the court. We keep drinking, and it drops completely out of sight on the other side. He called it a progressive illness or malady. And I read that book, and I think, my God, this is amazing. And now I realize that Silkworth and Wilson were some of the most incredibly astute observers that you can imagine, had seen a ton and recorded what they saw. And we spent the rest of this time proving why it happens. This is great. Doesn't make much difference to me as far as my being a drunk, but I got to tell you, I've sure taught a lot of doctors. And the first thing a doctor wants to know going in is, teach me the science. I say, well, let's talk about spirituality. Oh, hell, I know about spirituality. Teach me the science. They can't spell spirituality. But when you hook them with the science, then they're willing to go along and see what happens when you treat those things. I will just clear up something for anybody who may be ambivalent about this. You can be as perfect as you need to be, and you'll never be able to drink like a normal person if you have the disease that I have, the way I have it. The more I've learned about this disease, the more I am aware of the absolute power and presence of God. There ain't no way to get to where we are today from where we came from without God Almighty, or at least the spirituality that lets us get there. You can't treat our disease any other way. Because most of you have no clue of the wiring that we have. I just came back from an addiction conference in San Diego with some of the top pros in the country, and they've gone even to another level, and where they've gone to, I've sat there and studied and shared with them, and I'm thinking, it gets more beautiful every day. We are so wired backwards, and God can bring us together, and regardless of the wiring, we're able to function and do even more than that. We go to a whole different level. A whole different level. The power of prayer and God Almighty to deal with the wiring. No, but my thinking came back in my life. And this is where mentally different is the whole conglomerate that I walked into this program with. And if you're like me, every one of us has. And the program helps us deal with the thinking. I was taught early on, you stop the drinking and don't deal with the thinking. You go back to the drinking. And my thinking started way back then and dominated my whole action and reaction plan. This isn't psychobabble. Big book says it. We go back through our lives. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. Wilson not only invites us, he directs us in the fifth chapter and the fourth step. Go back and look at it, and told us exactly what to look for. Resentment, self-centeredness, dishonesty, and fear. To deal with the thinking. If I don't deal with it, and I have it with me every day, and the book tells me I'm going to have it. In the 10th step, I deal with that thinking that came from way back then. That's a plug in the soft underbelly, and it can be lighted up in a minute. As I go through this story, if time allows me to do it, I'll show you how it's affected virtually every relationship with women I've ever had because of the relationship I had with my mother. Give them what they want, and they'll take care of you and make you feel special. That ain't the way it works in society. Every woman I've ever been with, I gave her what she wants. And she didn't take care of me and make me feel special. She treated me like she'd treat anybody. She didn't treat me bad. But she didn't treat me like mama. And the thinking and the feeling that comes out of that. Alcohol and drugs were no problem for me in high school. I'd have an occasional beer with the guys. I was Mr. Perfect. I remember I laid in the bed the night before I left to go to college. I really was this good a guy. I remember looking up to see and saying, God, if I ever have a son, I want him to be just like me. You know, I was that good. I mean, and that would have been fine because I knew that I was really a nice guy, you know. But there'd be times during my high school career we'd have a beer occasionally. Then we'd sing gospel songs and go home and play Monopoly. That was it. Alcohol was no problem for me in college. I had an event that told me that I probably wouldn't be like normal people. I was the first Brady who ever went to college, and I went to a small college in central Kentucky where the women's campus on one side of town, the men's on the other side of town. And on Friday night, on Monday through Friday, I'd study. Saturday night, I'd go into the basement of the fraternity house. We'd drink 7 or 8 beers, get on the back of a flatbed truck, and go over to the women's campus and serenade the women. And while we were out there singing, I'd take off all my clothes and stand there buck naked just singing up a song. Nobody else got naked, just me. I used to say for humor that nobody called me, sent me flowers, or wrote me a note, or asked me for a date. But I'll tell you who did notice. The dean noticed. Brought me in and said, Burns, when you drink, you don't act right. We think that's your problem. You're a nice young man, and you're making good grades, but you better stop drinking. He said, you better stop getting naked, or you're not going to be able to stay here. So I quit drinking, quit getting naked, and graduated from college, and it worked cause and effect very well. I started medical school at the University of Louisville in 1958. This part of my story has to do with drugs, and I'm a card-carrying, commode-hugging, quart of whiskey, and 9-12-gauge shotgun in the mouth drunk. That's just what I am. But this is my story, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And this part of my story is about drugs. I've done I don't know how many fist steps with people, and I've found many of y'all have too. And if the format is followed, the big book format, pretty much you're going to hear the same things, except every now and then there's just something that's a little different. I think that's the peace God wants. That's the peace God wants to be carried. This person has a unique pitch right here. Well, mine is pretty unique in one respect. I took drugs, one drug, amphetamine, for 12 years with no other drug and not drinking. It destroyed me. Then I quit taking that drug and started drinking. In 8 years, I was drinking a quart of whiskey a night, just alcohol. So my message to y'all is what they keep teaching us out of treatment centers is a drug is a drug is a drug. Now, that's not what it is. But I can promise you that none of us who have my disease of alcoholism can process any other mood-altering medicine normally. Can't be done. If you're in here and think that you have quit smoking or quit drinking, but you can smoke a little dope, or you quit taking cocaine, you can do a little drinking, let me tell you, it ain't going to work. Now you can say, well, how in the hell do you know? Because I lived it for 20 years. And now we're being taught why that's true. But if you don't believe what the books say, just believe my experience. And that's my piece that's unique. Now, someone says, what about pain? Well, I guarantee you, we can take pain medicine as long as somebody's got us in a cage. You know? I mean, hell, I've been in 2 or 3 situations where if they didn't give me pain medicine, I'd have killed them. Pass a kidney stone one time, and you'll become very righteous about halfway through passing that kidney stone. I've had a major heart attack, and I mean, it was very painful. I've had a number of other medical stuff, and I guarantee you, if they don't give me pain medicine, then one of us is going to die right there in the emergency room. But I can tell you, every time I had to have it, I didn't come off of it like a normal person, because I've treated thousands of people. I know how they come off of it, and I know we don't, because I've treated thousands of them, and I've treated thousands of us. And it's a whole different mechanism coming off of it. And what do we say? I attend seminars and teach how to treat addicts for pain. And we say it in an AA meeting every time. I've got to take some medicine. Well, give it to your sponsor. Give it to your wife. Don't hold the medicine. Be sure they give you a day's supply. You talk to them 5 or 6 times a day, and you have the meeting in your home every night. And when I say this to doctors that I'm teaching, golly, does that work? We say it among ourselves, and we think it works beautifully. Anything less than that, we're at real risk. I started taking amphetamine to study. I didn't take it to get high. I didn't even know what it was. Some of the upperclassmen came down and gave me this pill to take because I was really torn up and couldn't study. I got on that pill, and within less than a month, I was taking it daily, and I got kicked out of medical school 2 weeks before graduation. In an amphetamine rage, I hit one of my professors. They took me to the head of the Department of Psychiatry and the dean and sat down and said, Burns, what's wrong with you? And I said, I take too many drugs. And they said, do you believe that? Yes, sir, I do. Then we can help you. Well, what are you going to do? We're going to put you in intensive psychiatric therapy. So for a year and a half, almost 2 years, I was in intensive psychiatric therapy, 2 different psychiatrists, twice a week for that whole period of time, didn't take any drugs, studied all my notes, felt great, understood everything I thought I needed to understand, and psychiatry did help me. Psychiatry was the first place that taught me that anger is not a primary feeling. It's a result of resentment and fear. Now, y'all, those of you who are in this program know that's the name of the game. That's where it's coming from with all the tools we got to work it out. But psychiatry taught me that in 1963. I got to y'all in 1977. So I came back into medical school ready to go, fired up, feeling great, knew all my top. I was ready to go. Walked in the University of Louisville hospital, and in less than an hour, I strung out again on amphetamine. Sat on the steps of the medical school and cried because I didn't know why. You know why. And in case you don't yet know that you know why, let me remind you why you know. Psychiatry brought me knowledge. We're not against knowledge in this program, at least I'm not. Wilson certainly wasn't. Psychiatry brought me knowledge. They didn't bring me the spiritual solution. It's real simple. I can screw up a one-car parade, but that's real simple. You know, that's real simple. So I didn't have a spiritual solution to a bunch of knowledge. They also taught me that I lusted after my mother, and I thought at the time I'm looking at him thinking, well, you crazy, man. He was crazy, you know. My mother died at 64, and I thought about it, and since then I laughed about it because I look at pictures of my mother today. My mother was a beautiful woman. But I never lusted after her, you know, I don't think. I'm scared to get any more therapy. Hell, I might find out things I don't want to find out, you know. I'm real happy where I am today, and I think I'll just stay the hell there, you know. My classmates enabled me. I'd get hot, and they'd take me home. I took it the whole that repeat year, and when I was married, had one small child, my friends would take me home, and I'd get too screwed up, and my wife would put me to bed, and I'd be there for 3 or 4 days and come back to medical school, told them I had the flu. They knew better, and many of them who are still alive told me, Burns, we knew what you were doing, but we thought, maybe someday he'll just grow up. You know? Maybe someday he'll realize his potential. I don't know of an alcoholic I've ever worked with that hadn't heard that from somewhere. Maybe one day he'll just grow up. You know, now they tell me that if they'd known what they know today, they would have done whatever they had to do because what they thought they were doing saving my career, and what it almost did was cost me my life. And I sure as hell don't have any resentments against those people, because some of them are some of my best friends, still the ones who are still alive, and they really did do what they thought was right. And as it's turned out, with God's example, that was right. If they'd directly dealt with that, I would have been kicked out of medicine and I would never be in it. And I got to tell you, there are damn few people on the face of God's earth that have done as much to bridge the world between us and medicine than me. And that's because I'm a doctor. The medical profession will listen to me. You may have the same message, it may be better, but they're not likely to listen to you. At least not at first. They're not rejecting you. They just think that you walked into a world you're not smart enough to live in. Talk to a doctor, for God's sakes. Only the privileged get to talk with doctors. Now, we don't mean to be that way. Hell, that's just the way we are. You know? I mean, even a nice guy like me had that for a while, but I'm so humble I got over it last week. It's amazing what school does to teaching doctors. Anyway, I got out of medical school and started my practice, was immediately admitted to the psych unit, and I was in the psychiatric unit in Louisville. Is this thing still on?
No, just about lower.
Huh?
It got lower.
Yeah. Okay, let me hold a minute, because I got so many good things to say, I don't want y'all to miss it. Can you hear it now? Is it back? Okay, let me. Yeah, I started my internship, started my residency, started my practice, got put in the mental hospital 4 times, strapped down IV fluid, straight jackets, padded cells. I might stay off amphetamine 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months. Always went back, always put me in the hospital. Finally finished my residency and started my practice for the for the first time where I was just doing it full time, and the Vietnam War was raging, and I was on amphetamine, and I was raging, and I was pissed at the Vietnam War, win it or get out, blah, blah, blah. And I was standing in the doctor's lounge one day, really raising hell about it, and one of my friends looked at me, and he said, Burns, I'm tired listening to you. If you don't like that war, go join. Now, by God, that's a good idea. And I went out and got in my car and drove to Frankfort, the capital of Kentucky, and in less than 2 hours, I was in the Army. Driving, didn't call my wife. Didn't call my office, just came back Captain Brady, ready to save the world, you know. Now, I go to 5 AA meetings a week, and I go because that was a part of my thinking and still is a part of my thinking, and that is, they say I have impulsivity. Well, I guess that's a surprise to any alcoholic that we have impulsivity. Yeah, if it drives fast, looks good, smells good, jump it or buy it. That's my philosophy right now, you know. And given more than 6 inches of chain, I'll hang myself. You know, I really will. I'll hang myself. So that thinking was back then. And I almost got put in Leavenworth in the Army. Post commander came down and said, Burns, you taking the amphetamine? Yes, sir. If you don't stop, we'll put you in Leavenworth. So I quit. Once he explained it to me, I quit. And I could always quit the drugs. I couldn't stay quit because I didn't have a program of recovery, but I could quit if the circumstances and the consequences were the way they were. I got to a point in my drinking where I couldn't quit. It was not possible for me to quit drinking. Came back home in 69, started my practice again, had a gallbladder attack. A good friend of mine took out my gallbladder. Another good friend of mine was the internist. We held hands in the hospital and prayed that I'd quit taking amphetamine. And that was my last amphetamine, 1969. Now, I'm sure the prayers had a lot to do with it, but let me tell you, the journey wasn't over. What I know took its place was drinking. For the first 4 years of my drinking, I didn't drink alcoholically. I might drink a lot. I might get drunk. I might not to get drunk. I never thought about it. I never said I'm not going to do it. I never said I am going to do it. The next 3 years of my drinking was alcoholic. Every morning when I got up, I knew what my first drink would be. I didn't drink, frankly, as much. I didn't get drunk as often, but my whole world was a drink. I would go to the office, see my patients on time, walk out of there at 4 o'clock because I knew my first drink was going to be at 4:30. I would walk across the 7-Eleven, get me a quart of beer, drink that beer on the 25-mile drive home, walk in and get my scotch and water and get smooth. Y'all remember smooth? Hell yes, you remember smooth. That's why you're in this room, because that's the last thing you remember. There will come a day we'll be unable to bring into our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation of a week or a month ago, paraphrased. We call this state condition learning. That's what medicine calls it. Wilson just said we forget because God gave us the privilege to forget and the absolute gift of having a room like this so I can remember every day of it because you brought me a solution and I don't have to live in shame. I live with it as an opportunity to help somebody else. And you bring that memory to me and we share the solution. In 1975, my wife kicked me out of the house. I womanized for about 2 years. I really thought I was hot stuff. You know, I wore one of those light blue, powder blue leisure suits and drove a Corvette and had a quart of whiskey. I mean, I wish I had a picture of that so I could look at that every now and then. By the time honest to God, there must have been people laughing at me all the way down here. But, I mean, I thought I was cool. Met a young woman who's now my wife, who's one of the finest human beings I've ever known. Casey's daddy was bipolar, and she watched her mother take care of her daddy. I watched my daddy take care of my mother, and we fit together just like that. She's taking care of me, I'm taking care of her, and we had that very sick but symbiotic relationship between two really good hearts and two really good people. We had a long journey to take, but so far we've taken it together. So we drank together, drink for drink. I kept getting sicker, and the last year I got so sick. I got so sick, and Casey is about 13, 14 years younger than I am, and it hadn't caught up with her yet. But it reached the point to where I would sit in the chair, because in the mornings I'd gotten to bed about, or I'd sit in that chair about 4 in the morning, And I wouldn't go to sleep because I thought if I don't go to sleep, the next day won't start, so I won't have to start the next day because the next day was going to be hell if I started it. So if I just do this, I won't start it. You say, what the hell logic is that? Well, it's no logic at all, but this room can relate to that, you know? And then I'd finally get to my office about 11 o'clock, see my patients, and wouldn't make hospital rounds until the evening so I could avoid the real doctors. Because I'd reached a point where I didn't think I was a doctor. I knew I was a technician, but I damn sure knew I wasn't the doctor that I wanted to be. When I came back from treatment, I reviewed all of my charts with my partner at that time for 5 years. And I practiced good medicine, technical medicine. But I'd lost the ability to walk in that room and listen to you talk about your pregnant daughter or listen to you talk about putting your mother or your father in a nursing home. I could diagnose your throat, your ears, your chest, your heart, all that stuff, but it was pure technician, and it had just nearly destroyed me. I would come home after I'd seen my patients in the hospital that evening, sit down with my quart of scotch on the floor. Casey would fix me a broil steak and baked potato, and I would eat that because I was saving my liver, you know. And then I put on my first record of the evening, which was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and the Philadelphia Philharmonic Orchestra doing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And I'd play that sucker for about 6 hours, full blast, just cry. I still cry. It's a great song. But, it's wonderful. I love the whole deal about it. Then my next record would be Neil Diamond's I Am, I said. Neil Diamond was my hero. You know, he said, I've got an emptiness deep inside and he won't let me go. I'm not a man who liked to swear, but I never cared for the sound of being alone. That's the alcoholic lament. And my hero had an alcoholic lament and was talking to a frigging chair. Does that tell you where I'd gotten to? Now, those of you who studied or really followed Neil Diamond, you know that he really had some problems in the 70s. And it was interesting because he talked to me a lot at that time through his records. This day, Casey had gone to work, and I knew it was over. Those of you who have had the feeling, you know what I mean. It was over. I couldn't go there anymore. And I asked God, I said, God, please help me. And immediately I knew what I wanted to do. And I walked in the bedroom, got my 12-gauge shotgun and put it in my mouth and I was out of here. And I mean, it was such relief. I sat there almost with joy. Because see, I believed in God. God lived in heaven on a cloud and looked like Charlton Heston. But I believed in God. I didn't know how to bring God into me to give me the power to deal with the problem. I thought the power was my power. Now, if you'd asked me that, I'd have thought, well, you're full of prunes. But that's exactly the way I lived, as though the power were mine. I called it being responsible when I didn't even have the tools to know what responsibility was. You know, our great work as hard as you can work, try as hard as you can accomplish anything. Well, I'm 68 years old. I can tell you that's bullshit. I'll never dunk a basketball. Never could when I was a fairly decent athlete. Tried till I almost tore my wrist off trying to dunk a basketball. But I was 5'10", and that wasn't going to happen. It just wasn't going to happen. I sit on that bed and I said, God, if you don't want me to go, give me a reason. Mom and Dad will be better off without me. My patients will be better off without me. Casey will be better off without me. And I got to my children. Now, I wasn't a Norman Rockwell father. I tell you, I'm a Norman Rockwell grandfather. But I wasn't a Norman Rockwell father because I just couldn't do it. But I thought of those children. I'd been in practice about 8 years, and I'd seen people come in to see me impaled on that spear of guilt about what they had done wrong, that daddy or mother or brother or sister killed themselves. What had they done wrong? Why couldn't they love them enough not to leave? And I knew if I pulled that trigger, my babies would live the rest of their life wondering about those things. At that moment of complete self-absorption, because that's what suicide is, that's not a pejorative term. At that moment of complete self-absorption, I've been there, so this isn't theoretical. At that moment of complete self-absorption, which means I have the power, I have the pain. I am the solution. And the solution wouldn't work. At that moment of complete self-absorption, it was years before I saw the significance of this. That moment of complete self-absorption, my God had me think of another human being. This program is not about me. It's about us. It's about our getting ready for them when they get ready to come to us. Our primary purpose, and those of you who know it in the book, is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man. I've had pros tell me I'm codependent. There was a time when I'd say, and you can kiss my codependent butt. But today I don't even have to say anything to them. Because I don't even know the answer. I just know the solution. It works very well for me. I come home many nights so tired that I'm almost sick. I've cut out my traveling and talking about 90% because I get so tired when I go. I've taken virtually everything that I know is God's will for me based on my sponsor and my support group, and most of my efforts are spent in Louisville and in Kentucky today. Mainly because I don't have to travel and I sleep on my own pillow. Because age is taking its toll like it will in anybody. But I'm still right there on the firing line, recognizing that the only solution for me is to get out of my self-centeredness by seeing what I can carry to you. And that day, that night in that little apartment, I thought of my children. I laid the gun down, the terror came back. I called a good friend of mine who's a psychiatrist, met him the next morning, walked in. David said, Burns, you got to go in the hospital. And I was looking at the mental hospital I'd been in. I said, David, I've been in there 4 times. It never works for me. But then I said, what would be the cornerstone of anybody's recovery? I'll do anything you tell me to do. I'll do anything you tell me to do. Thibault once says, the alcoholic that's going to recover generally gets to that point. However, once the crisis is over and the dust has risen, the ego will arise unscathed. You know? And the ego is not a bad term. The ego for me is when I am self-centered rather than God-centered. I used to think that being self-centered was a pejorative term. It's not. It's a description. I'm Brady-centered rather than God-centered. That's what self-centeredness means to me. And yes, it's something we deal with. I certainly deal with every day. Sent me off to treatment in New York. They detoxed me, shipped me to Atlanta. I was there for almost 4 months, came home to Louisville, came into Louisville when it was the best of times and the worst of times for AA. It was the best of times because the fellowship was indescribably wonderful. There were about 7 of us guys who hooked at the hip, and we ran together like the little pygmy elephants. I used to say, if the first elephant stops, the last elephant's going to have a brown nose. You know, that's the way it was. We ran like that. It wasn't 30 minutes early, 30 minutes late. It was 24/7. Our wives went with us on weekends. We cooked out together. We played golf together. We went on the river together. We were inseparable. And every one of us is still sober today, with one exception, and that one died, and he died sober. It was the best of times for the fellowship. I got a sponsor. This sponsor told me what to eat. He told me what to do. He told me where to sit. I mean, this man, I followed him like a lap dog. He sponsored the whole group. Yeah, it was called Raleigh's Raiders. We were goofier than hell, but we ran around together all the time, just like this. There's a condition called the post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Wilson first described it when he said for 1.5 years he couldn't get a job because he was racked with waves of self-pity and resentment. First time it was ever described. In 1979, medical science published it. For 6 months to 2 years, we don't have good memories. For 6 months to 5 years, we have simple problem-solving stress management screwed up. Any of you early in the first 2 to 5 years of recovery and you think, oh God, they'll find out I don't know shit. Well, no, we know you don't know shit. Look, this isn't a criticism. It's an acceptance of what's been published. And the way it manifested in my life, Man, I would get up in the morning, and I'd read my meditation book, and I'd think, that's beautiful, and close it and couldn't remember it. I'd read the damn newspaper and close it and couldn't remember it. And hell, all I was reading was the sports page and the funnies. I mean, this wasn't higher mathematics. I mean, this is the truth. I would go in my office, and I could wear a white coat and a stethoscope, and I could walk in, and I could take care of you. I'd walk out in the hall, and sometimes I'd just stand there and start shaking. This went on for 2 years, just stand there and start shaking. I'd go in my little inner office, get on my knees, say, God, please help me, pick up a phone call, Jim, say, Jim, I'm flying apart. Did you get up on time? Yeah. Do your meditation? Yeah. Did you eat your breakfast? Yeah. Did you get the office on time? Yeah. You going to eat your lunch today? Yeah. You'll be fine. Are you coming to the meeting tonight? Yeah. You'll be fine. Thanks, Jim. Hung up, felt better. You know, and maybe 6 hours, 6 minutes, 30 minutes, there it was again. And if, Jim, I'm flying apart. Did you get up on time? Yeah. Did you do your meditation? Same drill. I mean, I lost my car in my own parking lot one time. And there are only 8 parking spaces. Now, you think, oh, Burns is just saying this for humorous effect. No, I drove my wife's car. Had forgotten I drove it, parked it in there, walked out to leave and started crying. Went in and said, Dave, somebody has stolen my car. And he went out there and he said, Burns, you drove Casey's car. I said, that's right, I forgot. Honest to God, it was that bad. So if you think you've got a wet brain, no, you haven't. If you can find this room, you haven't got a wet brain. I went to see a psychiatrist. Went to church, went to see a psychiatrist, came to AA, got me a sponsor, anything that I thought that would help. And I saw this psychiatrist on Tuesdays, and I'd see him on Thursday. I'd go in on Thursday, and Homer said, Burns, I want you to start with where we were on Tuesday. And I'd say, I don't remember where we were. He'd say, you're blocking your therapy. And I'd go, oh, God, I'm a worm. I'm blocking my therapy, for God's sakes. You know how we feel like a piece of crap, so somebody says that. So I went into the meeting. Anybody got a problem? I got a problem. What's the problem? I'm blocking my therapy. Okay, tell us about it. And I told him about some of the old-timers would say, well, Burns, we talked about that 3 nights ago. That's the first thing. The other thing is, do you remember where his office is? Yeah. And he said, well, hell, son, that's as good as it's going to get for about 2 minutes. So if you could find this meeting and you can find your car when you leave, well, just take that off the table. You may not find your car. You may have to wait till everybody leaves and drive the last one standing for all I know. You know? And not everybody's that way, but if you're that way, just hang in there, troops, because I promise you, if you can get here and eat your breakfast without putting it in your ear, you're going to be okay. I tell you, my mother died when I was 8 months sober, and I drove down every weekend to see mother. She died of real bad metastatic cancer, and she died on a Friday night, and she put her in the hospital Friday morning. I was going down Friday night because I went home every time she got put in the hospital multiple times. Well, she died that night, and I was going to go down on Saturday because I had my office hours. And when she died, they called me and told me she died, and I called my sponsor. Jim was 20 years older than me. He was about 6'5", weighed about 260, and he came out to the office and sat in my chair, and I crawled up in his lap with a white coat and stethoscope on, and he rocked me. He rocked me. And I let him hold me just like a baby. I want you to remember that story, because I'll tell you one later on that shows you none of us are perfect. But I'll never forget that. And I will love him to the day he or I or both of us die. It was the worst of times for AA in Louisville, because no one talked about the book and no one talked about the steps. The drill was, don't drink, get a sponsor, tell him what's wrong with you, he'll tell you what to do, and then go save a drunk. My first fourth step outside of a treatment center, for what such as it was 4 years sober when my sponsor called Hazleton and got a 300-question questionnaire, and I took it. My second fourth step, 8 years sober, was he made up 200 questions, gave them to me, and I took it. I lived the first 10 years of this program on a 3 1/3 step in the fellowship. The first 3 steps, and I let him hold me just like a baby. I want you to remember that story, because I'll tell you one later on that shows you none of us are perfect, but I'll never forget that, and I will love him to the day he or I or both of us die. It was the worst of times for AA in Louisville, because no one talked about the book and no one talked about the steps. The drill was, don't drink, get a sponsor, tell him what's wrong with you, he'll tell you what to do, and then go save a drunk. My first fourth step outside of a treatment center, for what such as it was, it was 4 years sober when my sponsor called Hazleton and got a 300-question questionnaire, and I took it. My second fourth step, 8 years sober, was he made up 200 questions, gave them to me, and I took it. I lived the first 10 years of this program on a 3 1/3 step in the fellowship. The first three steps were mine in the second. If you're in this room, you got the first three steps. My experience will be you will continue to enlarge on it. You'll continue to evolve it. But you're in this room because you're powerless over alcohol. Your life's unmanageable. You've come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity. And you made a decision to turn your life and your will over to the care of God. Now, maybe he served eggs this morning. That may have attracted you somewhat, but you're still in this room because of the first three steps. And I was devoutly committed to helping drunks. I mean, it got so bad they'd say, here he comes, drink a beer because he's going to take your ass off treatment anyway, you know? And I became a doctor in a world where no other doctors lived in Louisville who were recovering. I mean, I had 40 to 50 patients a day telling me I was God. I don't care how many doctors sending all their patients to me who had alcohol problems. The only person who called me, hey, you, was my sponsor. Praise God. I now run the impaired physician program in the state of Kentucky. We've dealt with 900 doctors in Kentucky. I was the founding member of an indigent home which sleeps 400 men and women a night. And we got 250 in a year-long program of recovery. Yeah, I believe in service. But by God, where I was a loaded gun. I was a lethal weapon for God. That's exactly what, I mean, I drag people to treatment, they'd come out and they think, I ain't staying with that crazy son of a bitch, I'm getting out of here, you know. And the ones who stayed sober did, the ones who stayed sane did. So I lived that way for 10 years. My wife and I had a wonderful relationship. I put her here on my hip, and I was a benevolent dictator, and everywhere we went, she went too. I wanted her to have the best clothes money that I could afford, so each season I would have clothes sent to her, never ask her what she wanted. I wanted to have a new car every 2 years and had one delivered. Never asked her what she wanted. Wanted to take really nice vacations, and we did. Never asked her where she wanted to go. We had great sex. I know we did everything I wanted to do, you know. But I adored her, and she adored me, and we ran this life. And finally she heard her story, came in and curled up on my lap and said, Burns, I want to go to AA. I said, I think that's great. I've been through more 12 steps with this and enough therapy to know exactly what I felt was, you're leaving me. You broke the script. You're supposed to stay home, cook my meals, and wait up till I get home and be warm and loving while I tell you how hard the day has been. Now, I'm not that big an a-hole. That's just the way it played out, because that was the way I saw it play out. So Casey had abandoned me, and immediately, if you don't have somebody there to take care of you and make you feel special, what do? You go find somebody. That's why there are people in this program on their 6th, 7th, and 8th relationship. Because praise God for my commitment to this program and my wife's commitment to this program, we saved that marriage. Because within about 2 months, I was having an affair with my nurse. Nurses take care of doctors and make them feel special. Now, the new nurses don't. They don't buy that crap. But the old nurses did. The old nurses did. And this was a wonderful woman, divorced, had 2 children. And she really is a class act. She's married now. I've made my amends to her. Casey and I spent almost 2 years in therapy working that out. But nevertheless, what happened is I started finding me somebody else to take care of me. If you'd asked me that, I said, hell no. That's not what it's all about. I really love this woman. Now, unfortunately, I happen to love 2 women, my wife and this woman. And I used to remember sitting at 52 years of age with 10 years of sobriety, 51 years of age with 10 years of sobriety, thinking, how can I get these 2 women to agree for all of us to live together? And it made all the sense in the world to me. Hell, I'm not sure it still doesn't make sense, for God's sake. It just doesn't seem to be the way things are done. I could have done it. In any event, I had about a 3-month affair with her, and I went to my sponsor, and I would always suggest that you talk to your sponsor first. But I went to my sponsor. I'll tell you why I didn't go to him belly up. I know he'd tell me no, and I knew I wouldn't have done it because I wanted his approval that bad. So I was going to do it. Then I realized, hey, I got to get rid of this stuff, because the one thing I'm doing that nobody can do and stay sober is I'm lying. Yeah. This is a lie. This is not rigorous honesty, and only people who can't get this program, people who can't be honest. That's what the book told me. We read it today. So I went and told Jim. I said, Jim, I'm having an affair with my nurse. And he said, well, quit. I said, okay. So I got in the car to drive home, and before I got home, he'd called my wife and told her. Now, there's a great lesson to be learned from this. Sponsors are not God. I've had 3 sponsors in 27 years. Wouldn't be without one. But the evolution of my appreciation for a sponsor is I made my first sponsor God. I can tell you, if I sponsor anybody from day one, I say, if you expect me to walk on water, you better show me where the damn stumps are, because I can't do it. I'll give you everything I got, and today we'll deal with our imperfections and find God as a way to deal with that. But we're not God. We are wonderful angels, but we are not God. I've had people say, are you denigrating sponsorship? Listen to my talk before you have a stupid response, you know? I wouldn't be without a sponsor, but they're not God. At about 10 years in sobriety, when that sponsor had to go, there was no trust. People always say, why'd he do it? The issue is not why'd he do it. The issue is, what did I do with it? A little pigeon of mine came up at that time with 8 tapes in his hand, said, listen to these and see if they're any good. And they were Joe and Charlie's tapes of the Big Book. As I listened to those tapes, I realized the program I didn't have. 11 of us sat down together with the tapes and with the Big Book, and we did our first Big Book study in Louisville at that time in approximately 1987. Today there are at least 40 or 50 Big Book studies going on at all times because we started them. What I found out in that book is my problem is not alcohol. That's what it says. Alcohol is a symptom, bottles a symbol. Alcohol caused me a lot of problems, but it wasn't my problem. It was the medicine for my problem. I drank alcohol to deal with my problem. All of that thinking and all of that weird wiring. And now my medicine was away. I was crazy. And I found for the first time through the Big Book my problem's the way I think. Wilson's called it the peculiar mental twist. It's the drink, it's the thinking that precedes the drinking, and it's a well-structured process. The drink may occur on Friday night or Saturday night, but the relapse started 6 months ago. And how to deal with that is what this whole program is about for me on a daily basis, is to deal with that thinking. And the 3 parts of the peculiar mental twist for me, and the book never really describes them except in Jim's story, and more about alcoholism. First part, bigger than the rules. Ask yourself today, as I have you done things today bigger than the rules? Not big things. Sped driving over here. Sitting in this room pissed off at somebody. Basically didn't call somebody you know you should have called, a child, a wife, whoever. We have rules. Silkworth said we had rules. I start my day with the 11th step, 3rd step, 7th step. I live my day with the 10th step, and I close my day with the 11th step, just the way it's written. Virtually every day is followed with that. Now, occasionally, I'll get up in the morning, and I'll be running around, and I'll say, get in the shower, dear God, please direct my thing, keep my thoughts free, myself, serious, honor, resentment, fear, jump in the car, take off, driving to work, somebody honks at me, and I say, screw you, and there we are. Light turns green, somebody honks behind me, and I'm giving them the sign for the rest of the trip. I've even been known as recently as a month ago to follow someone to an exit off of the expressway, follow them down the damn road, giving them a finger all the way down the road while they're looking in the mirror. I mean, this is a spiritual giant in relapse. Bigger than the rules. Bigger than the rules. Park in a handicapped parking zone. I can do it. I'm only going to be here about 30 seconds. Bigger than the rules. Second piece of peculiar mental twist is victimization. Peter, you're my problem. John, you're my problem. Somebody in this room is my problem. My wife's my problem. Victims may not drink. They just don't ever get sober. They're too busy blaming everything on everybody else. Talked at an Al-Anon conference about 4 years ago. I was an AA speaker at 8 o'clock in the morning. The alcoholics came, got me. We went in to have our breakfast. The setups were all around. We had to go through the line like that. I came back to the table where I was sitting, sit down. The setups were gone. And I got ready to go over this woman and very spiritually asked her what the hell she'd done with my setups. And as I walked over there, I took about 3 steps and realized I'd sat down at the wrong table. But my immediate response was, she screwed me. The IRS screwed me. My ex-wife screwed me. Bush is going to screw me. Everybody's going to screw me. The people in the medical school screwed me. You say, you don't have much. You have trust issues. Hell yes, I've got trust issues. That's what you people have helped me deal with. It's called resentment and self-pity. Final one is square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. If the square peg won't fit in the round hole, get a hammer and just beat the hell out of it. Sorry, God. Just make the world fit. That's called control. It comes directly from fear. There'll be some of us in this room today who will drink. Not a one of us will drink because we don't believe we're an alcoholic. We know that. We may not like it. We may say we're not, but we know it. Those of us who drink again will drink because we don't believe and don't do and deal with the second half of the first step. Trying to manage life. Every problem I've got today is a first step. Please hear this. Every problem I've got today is a first step problem. Trying to manage life. And every solution I've got is a 12-step solution. Not the 4th and 5th, not the 6th and 7th, not the 8th and 9th, all 12. When I hear somebody to me say, I think that's a 4th and 5th step problem. Starts at the first step and goes all the way through to a spiritual awakening. The only answer for a person who, and that was of course fear, like me, who has that peculiar mental twist is spiritual. Let me take the smoke, mirrors, and magic out of it. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Doesn't say having a spiritual awakening as a result of having a sponsor. Doesn't say having a spiritual awakening as a result of going to meetings. It says having a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. When I had the spiritual awakening finally, I was able to appreciate the spiritual experience of having a sponsor, of going to meetings, and the many miracles that had happened in my life. Because I had had an awakening to be able to see the miracle. About 5 years ago, I did not think that this program was giving me what I thought it should, or I didn't think I was doing it. I went in to talk to my sponsor, took my wife with me, and we talked to a therapist who is in recovery. Casey and I, incidentally, between 14 and 15 years of sobriety, we spent 2 years in therapy. She working a strong 12-step program, me working a strong 12-step program, in with a therapist who appreciate that's the only solution for an alcoholic to his problems, or an alcoholic like me. And we went through reconstructing, healing that marriage. I made my amends to everybody. And Casey and I have the best marriage in the world today, the best relationship you can imagine. In any event, where in the hell was I?
5 years ago.
Yeah, 5 years. Thank you. I'm going to take you home with me. You're listening. I can't get anybody else to listen, but I'll tell you, whoever that was, I'll take you home. 5 years ago, we went in to talk, and this therapist looked at me, and he said, Burns, you don't know how to step off on the shore, do you? I said, no, I don't. He said, let me ask you to do something. I said, sure. He said, why don't you start looking for the miracle in the ordinary? Quit looking for a burning bush, or be able to appreciate that not all burning bushes burn. And I began a journey of being able to see the miracle in the ordinary, like this room. And let me give you how simple it got for me. About 3 years ago, we were in England, and my stomach was in real bad shape. We're getting ready to fly back. Going to be at least a 24-hour day, and we're getting on the plane to leave, and are we getting ready to going through the hangar, whatever we went through, going through, and as I was walking through, I said, God, please help my stomach. I need to watch after Casey. She's diabetic, and please help me. Please help me. And I had this terrible need to go to the bathroom. So I went in there and had this incredible bowel movement. I mean, it was just a thing of beauty. I mean, you know, I came out, and as I was walking across the floor, I said, God, please thank you. Please let me thank you for that bowel movement. And I got home, and I felt wonderful. I got home and told my group, my men's group, and they said, my goodness, we're going to have to call this Burns Brady's holy shit. And that, but this is the truth. Then about two years ago, I began to realize I'd never known peace. Rarely had ever known peace. I've known happiness. I've known joy. But rarely have I known peace. And I began to study Bill Wilson, actually before 2 years ago, but really intensely in some peripheral stuff. And I came across Ed Dowling and his effect with Bill Wilson. It opened up a whole new vista for me. When Wilson was living in the 1940, they were living in their first little clubhouse. Lois is gone. It's 10 o'clock at night. It's in November. It's cold as hell. He's got a caretaker there who comes up and said, there's somebody here to see you. Well, this was Ed Dowling. Dowling was a Jesuit priest from St. Louis who, frankly, if it weren't for Dowling, I'm not sure where we'd be today. Because he was basically Wilson's whole guiding light from 1940 to 1960 when Dowling died. And so Dowling comes up the step. Wilson said, yeah, tell him to come on up. Wilson was tired. 10 o'clock at night, he could hear the cane coming. Wilson's about 6'4". Dowling's about 5'6", or 7". Dowling comes in, shocky white hair, little pugsy face. Wilson said, take off your coat. He took off his coat and he saw his collar. Wilson loved men of the collar. As they began to talk with the exchange they had, Wilson asked Dowling, he said, will I ever know peace? He said, no. He said, why? He said, because you've been blessed with divine dissatisfaction. Your seeking will lead so many people to the light. You have been chosen. Well, let me tell you, this room has been chosen. This is God's army. We are the wounded. And in this army, the wounded soldiers not only serve, we serve on the front line. I have known peace. The very moment I know it, and as fleeting as it may be, as I'm sitting there looking at another alcoholic, 4 days sober, looking in his eyes, and he looks at me, and he knows that I know that he knows. And the game is on. The whole world changes for both of us. My mother died in 1978. My daddy married again within a year. My daddy needed a woman in his life. Praise God, he married a wonderful friend of his and mother's. And I went down to make my amends to daddy. I made them to mother. She didn't, no problem, but I tried to talk to daddy, and daddy wouldn't let me make my amends. My daddy's one of the most wonderful people I've ever known. He was always so quiet, so powerful. But I didn't see daddy much for 10 years because we were so poor. He was working 3 jobs. And I wanted daddy's approval so bad I could taste it. I've held men in my lap at the healing place that have been in prison because about 90% of our population has, and rubbed the back of their hair as they cried and told me something. And I said, it's okay. What they wanted was another man's approval. And I wanted daddy's approval, and daddy couldn't do it. Peggy told me after daddy died that daddy was so ashamed of himself because he thought he had caused my alcoholism. Daddy began to develop Alzheimer's, and I couldn't even talk to him. We put him in a nursing home. I would drive down every Sunday. This was when this miracle was happening in my life, and I'd drive down every Sunday to see him. And on the way down, I'd say, God, take away my pain. Please take away my pain. I'd park at the nursing home, go in, try to help Daddy. It didn't work. Get in the car and cry all the way back. This Sunday, I'm going down. This whole miracle is exploding in me. And I walked in for reasons I'll never know. I walked in that nursing home saying, dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. That's a lot different from take away my pain. Daddy was in a wheelchair. Didn't call him daddy. That confused him. I walked in. I said, Hal, how are you? He said, fine, Buster. He thought I was his brother. I said, can I help you? He said, would you shave me? And I shaved daddy. Then I said, would you like some breakfast or some lunch? He said, yeah. And I rolled him out in his wheelchair and fed him. He was too weak to feed himself. Peggy came in, sat down. Peggy and I got to talking. Daddy was watching. He used to love to watch Mother and me talk. He just used to love it. Wouldn't say anything. Just used to love it. Daddy would never hug me or say, I loved you. He was just always there when I needed him. he was watching us talk. Finally, I turned and said, would you like to go out on the porch? And he said, I believe I would. And I took him out on the porch. Peggy and I got to talking. Daddy sits up in his chair and he said, son, today you just like the little boy your mother and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. 10 seconds later, he didn't know me and he never did again. As a doctor, I can explain what happened in the circuitry of his brain. It was some years before I could explain the real miracle. And the real miracle was that this self-centered alcoholic said, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. That was the miracle. That's what we're all about. That's what we do. And we're damn good at it. Good breakfast. Appreciate being here. Thank you very much.
We want to, the West Side Men's Group wanted to show our gratitude for Burns for coming to speak for us today. And a small token of it is we made a reproduction of the poster that Mark made, something maybe you can hang in your office or your home.
I certainly will.
We thank you again.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, one last mention. Our program today was recorded by Chuck and Loretta of Vision Audio. They have tapes and CDs available of this particular program and several others.
The whole program is two tapes and two CDs.
The entire program is two tapes and two CDs. We also have last year's breakfast and several other great speakers. So please see them afterwards. The one last thing I wanted to say was just we had about three times as many people at this breakfast as we had last year. And that's big. And so what that means was for the $5 ticket, you got a little bit of food for your stomach. You got a little more food for your soul. But what you really did was you supported your local intergroup so that meetings will be there when the newcomer needs them. And I think that's the most important work we all did here today. So thank you. Okay. And one more hand, please, for our speaker, Burns Gray. And I'd like to have Josh come up and lead us in the closing with the Lord's Prayer. Please, Josh.
Have a moment of silence for all the sick and suffering in and out of these rooms, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom,